Today is Saturday, November 5th. Starting this weekend, governments, businesses, and scientific leaders from around the world are gathering in Egypt for the annual United Nations Climate Change Conference, known as COP27. To curb the effects of global warming, a lot of emphasis has been put on reaching a specific goal: net zero emissions by the year 2050. That deadline is to basically give countries and industries time to implement the changes that most scientists say are needed to avoid triggering irreversible, catastrophic effects of climate change. But what does that transformation to net zero really mean? And what does it really look like in our daily lives? Dr. Mikkala Krishnan says it'll fundamentally change every system. She's a partner at the McKinsey Global Institute, and she co-authored a research report that analyzed the economic impact of these changes, the major society-wide shifts that would have to happen from jobs and cars to the foods we eat and beyond. Welcome, welcome to the Newsworthy Special Edition Saturday, when we sit down with a different expert or celebrity every Saturday to talk about something in the news. Don't forget to tune in every Monday through Friday for our regular episodes, where we provide all the day's news in 10 minutes. I'm Erica Mandy. It's now time for today's Special Edition Saturday. Dr. Mikkala Krishnan, thank you so much for coming on the Newsworthy.
Great to be here.
First, just to make sure everyone's on the same page and can follow along with what we're talking about, can you please just briefly summarize what net zero really means and why there's a focus on the year 2050?
What we mean is net zero emissions of what are called greenhouse gases. This is gases like carbon dioxide or methane that contribute to warming of the planet. What we mean when we say net zero emissions is that any greenhouse gases that are released by human activities are balanced by removing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere in a process that's called carbon removal. So anything we add to the atmosphere, we also take out from the atmosphere. Every year, we will be continuing to add greenhouse gas emissions to the atmosphere. We'll just be adding less and less as we move out to that 2050 target. So what that gives us is firstly 30 years to get to that net zero so that we're not abruptly trying to reduce emissions. We'll essentially limit our warming of the planet to about 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is the amount that climate scientists say is important to restrict warming to prevent triggering catastrophic climate change and various kinds of feedback effects.
So your report focuses on the economic changes that would need to take place to achieve that net zero carbon emissions globally by the year 2050. And I want to break down a few different parts of that. But first, what would you say would be the most significant change?
We're talking about fundamentally changing every system of energy and land use, how we produce energy, how we consume energy, how we produce food, how we consume food, entirely changing all of these systems that exist around us. So it has implications on capital. It has implications on jobs. So where people work, the industries they work in, potentially also the geographic distribution of jobs. We expect to see as the world transforms to net zero, for example, that the fossil fuel sector starts to ramp down. But new sectors also grow. So sectors like renewable power start to grow. So there's a fundamental demand shift that occurs. And then finally, with all of this, there is an implication to think through on costs. So as we change how we produce and we consume, the costs of different types of goods and services could also shift.
Let's break it down into a few of those. What about energy or power? What would the transition mean for average consumers?
The power system today consists of producing electricity through the combustion of coal or natural gas, for the most part. And so we need to transform that power system to be one that doesn't produce these emissions. The typical way that is being conceived of to do that is to use renewable-based power, so power that is produced from solar and wind. The power system will also need to be fundamentally scaled. We need a bigger power system because things that rely on fossil fuels, sectors that rely on fossil fuels, like driving your car, will also now need to be powered not through the combustion or burning of oil or gas in your tank, but instead through electric vehicles. So fundamentally, while there are disagreements about the exact nature of what a future power system looks like, what it fundamentally involves is a decarbonized as well as a larger power system, most likely with substantial renewables capacity in the system.
Right, because today there's not enough renewable power that would ever match what we're using.
Absolutely. So we've definitely scaled the amount of renewable power that exists in the world. Renewable penetration has increased. But then if you think about the share of power that is being produced by renewables today globally, it is a tiny share of the overall power mix and overall energy mix. And so then if you think about the impact of this on costs to consumers, if you look out to 2050, there is an expectation that overall power costs might actually be lower than today or on par, at least compared to today, because renewables essentially, once you've built them, are a free resource, right? We're essentially using the power of the sun or using the power of wind to operate renewable power. In the short run, we actually need to build out a bunch of this renewable capacity, right? So we need to make investments, we need to deploy capital to build out these systems, and that could come with a cost. So time frame matters. The second thing that matters is place. Are you in a geography where you have ample access to wind and to sunshine? That matters because if you aren't in a place like that, you will need to spend on backup capacity, things that will power your system when the sun is not shining or the wind is not blowing. So the design of this system, the pace with which we deploy this system, what we use given the specific resources in a given geography will all influence the cost of this energy system.
What you just talked about makes me think of some states, you know, requiring all new cars sold in their state to be electric cars, I think by the year 2030. Will the state be equipped to charge all of those cars by the time that happens? Like that, those are the types of questions we at least have to ask, right?
The good news is actually from a purely technological innovation standpoint, we're much further along than one might think. But there's a whole set of other things that we need to do. And I think that's where the world needs to start pivoting its attention. We need to put in place what we call the physical building blocks for the transition. This is things like scaling up supply chains to actually manufacture batteries. It's things like having EV charging infrastructure. It's things like having enough natural resources. Lithium for batteries is a commonly cited example. We also need to pivot attention to what I would call the economic and societal adjustments we need for the net zero transition. We've talked a little bit about energy costs, for example, and the implication to consumers. But it's also things like how do we scale the capital that we need for net zero, right? How do we actually create the right projects? How do we finance them? Who pays for this? How do we manage worker dislocations? So there's a whole set of economic and societal adjustments that need to be made. And then finally, we need commitments, we need standards, we need governance to drive this transition effectively.
Will Americans specifically, or I guess people all around the world, be required to change the food they eat?
So if you think about what contributes to agriculture and food emissions, there's certainly a part of it that comes from how we actually produce food, right? A simple example is tractors on farmland. Are they fossil fuel powered or powered by low carbon sources? But it's much more than that. It's also how we think about fertilizer use. The production of fertilizer actually relies enormously on energy. So how do we think about fertilizer use and using that effectively? There's also now questions about, do we need to think about food demand in an entirely different way? One part of that is food waste. About 30% of food across the world that's produced is wasted before it's consumed. But then the other action that is being increasingly talked about is shifting the nature of our diets. So diets that rely on beef and on lamb, what are called ruminant-based proteins, are ones that have relatively higher emissions just because of the nature of the underlying production practices. And so there is a question of, will diets need to shift towards types of food that produce less emissions? Now, that doesn't mean everybody needs to become a vegetarian. There's various options that are quite interesting that are being explored. Certainly, moving to poultry-based meats relative to ruminant-based meats is one way where you could have a relatively lower emissions footprint. There's also entirely new companies now that are creating alternative meat. I would say that it certainly can be a part of the equation, but it needs to be balanced with things like nutritional requirements and are they being appropriately met, as well as, of course, cultural norms and individual preferences.
Coming up, who would pay for all of these changes? Plus, our guest expert answers the question, is this goal of net zero emissions by the year 2050 even possible? More of that conversation still ahead. But first, a quick break to thank our sponsors. The Newsworthy is brought to you by Rothy's. I love the cozy feeling of fall, from big sweaters to cinnamon-topped lattes. Well, let Rothy's be your newest obsession for fall and every season after. Rothy's just launched two new sustainably made sneakers with extraordinary comfort for all-day wear. So what do I mean by sustainable? They are made with recycled single-use plastic bottles. Yes, your shoes. So I love knowing that my Rothy's shoes are not only stylish and comfortable, they are also better for the planet. Whether you like the luxe slip-on or a laid-back lace-up, you'll feel extraordinary comfort with each step, and they're built to last. Rothy's are 100% machine washable, which is especially helpful if you get white sneakers like I have. They'll be your favorite shoes for years to come. Oh, and in addition to Rothy's new sneakers, Rothy's original slip-on sneaker won Best Slip-on Sneaker from Self Magazine's 2022 Sneaker Awards. So get stylish shoes, versatile and durable enough to wear all the time with Rothy's. Get $20 off your first purchase at rothys.com/newsworthy. That's R-O-T-H-Y-S, rothys.com/newsworthy. And thanks to our other sponsor, KiwiCo. This is the first holiday season that my son will be old enough to engage with us and really enjoy the season with us. And so when I'm thinking about what gifts to give him or the other kids in our extended family, I love knowing that KiwiCo always sparks fun and excitement for kids of all ages every time. KiwiCo delivers super cool science, technology, and art projects for kids. And it's truly unique to each kid. They have 9 different subscription lines for different ages and categories. My 1-year-old's experience so far with KiwiCo has been so positive that I bought my 5-year-old niece a 3-month subscription last holiday season, and I'm so excited to do it again because I heard all about how much she loved it. Plus, I really appreciate knowing KiwiCo uses high-quality materials. And there's no commitment, so you can pause or cancel your subscription anytime. Give awesome this holiday with KiwiCo. And listen up, because you can get your first month free on any crate line at kiwico.com/newsworthy. That's your first month free at kiwico.com, kiwico.com/newsworthy. Okay, now back to my conversation with Dr. Mikala Krishnan.
And what about the impact on jobs? What are the pros and cons of these types of changes?
What we found was that overall, about 200 million jobs would be created as a result of this net zero transition by 2050. About 185 million jobs would be lost as a result of the transition. So jobs would be lost in sectors like the fossil fuel sector, which in that scenario declined. Jobs would be gained in sectors like the renewable power sector, which grew in that scenario. What's more interesting when you think about these numbers is the fact that it is fundamentally a transformation from certain sectors that decline to other sectors that grow. So there's going to need to be a big transition across sectors, which in turn comes with, you know, an entirely new set of skills, an entirely potentially new set of companies. And so that sectoral shift will need to be managed when you think about jobs.
Right. Can one worker go from one sector to another, or are we talking about totally different workers getting the new types of jobs?
Exactly. And as part of that, also the geography of jobs, right? One of the things that we looked at for the U.S. was we examined counties in the U.S. that had jobs in what I would call fossil-based sectors. So this is, coal extraction or oil and gas refining or fossil-based power. And we found that there were about 44 counties in the U.S. where 10% or more of jobs were in these sectors. So I think there's also this very important question as we think about jobs on not just the net numbers or the overall numbers, but where are specific geographies where there are likely to be higher impacts, and how do we ensure that workers in those geographies don't get left behind as we undertake the transition?
You've also looked into how poorer countries would fare compared to wealthier nations like the U.S. What did you find?
There's a category of countries, lower income countries, as well as fossil-based economies, that are disproportionately exposed to the transition, meaning their economies will have to more fundamentally transform relative to other parts of the world. A larger share of their economies are in sectors that are most affected by the transition. They are in manufacturing industries like steel and cement. They're in fossil extraction industries, etc. And so the economic transformation relative to GDP for these countries is disproportionately high. The second challenge is, as we think about the investments that we need to make to get to net zero emissions, building all the power capacity, transforming how we drive, rethinking heating in buildings or cooling in buildings, developing countries need to spend more relative to their GDP compared to the developed world. The third thing is, we haven't talked about this as yet, is actually the impacts of climate change. The physical risks from a changing climate, impacts of heat, impacts of flooding, impacts of water stress, would be disproportionately felt in the poorer parts of the world, in lower income countries relative to developed countries. And so for all of these reasons, it's almost a triple whammy for certain parts of the world. We need to think about the role that global collaboration, collective action, cross-border finance flows, global innovation, all that global coordination, how we enable that to get to net zero as a global community.
Which is then connected to the question of who pays for all of this.
Absolutely. I think the who pays question is really the elephant in the room. What our research would find is that today we're spending about $5.7 trillion on these energy and land use systems that I described, on power, on mobility, on buildings, on industry, etc. Going forward, to get to net zero, that $5.7 trillion would need to increase to $9.2 trillion. So that's a $3.5 trillion, trillion with the T increase. So there's significantly more per year for the next 30 years. And that raises all sorts of questions around how do we actually finance this? What's the role of the public sector? What's the role of the private sector? What's the role of the consumer? How do we think about enabling capital to flow from developed countries to developing countries? So finance really has such a crucial role to play as we think about getting to net zero.
Dozens of countries, thousands of companies have all made these net zero pledges. So based on your research, do you think achieving net zero carbon emissions by 2050 is actually a realistic goal?
It's a very, very challenging task. If you think about all the commitments that companies and countries have made, firstly, the commitments don't even keep us to 1.5C. And then the transition of action plans to action is also very much still underway. So this is really a very, very challenging, difficult task that lies ahead of us. I do think it's important as we contemplate this task, though, to keep the end goal in mind, right? Because ultimately, what all of this mobilization transformation does is it prevents the most catastrophic impacts of climate change. And so there is a vital imperative to make these investments, but do so recognizing the challenges that lie ahead and putting in place mechanisms to manage them.
And I believe in your report, though, it said there are still unknowns about the impact of net zero emissions by 2050, that maybe it won't even have the impact that we're hoping it does. Can you explain?
Yeah, there's two aspects of that. One is, of course, as we think about this 1.5 degrees Celsius limit that I've described, there is some emerging science that suggests we may already be locked into 1.5 degrees Celsius of emissions.
Like it's too late.
Exactly, right? Meaning we've already started to trigger what climate scientists call feedback loops, things that almost enhance warming above and beyond what is caused by human activities alone. So I think there are questions on the physical risk side of things as to, is having emissions by 2030, getting to net zero by 2050, is that going to be enough? But I think even on the scale of transformation that I've been describing, I would say what we've analyzed is a first order view almost of that, right? Because it's almost unfathomable to think about how much we'll need to shift in how the economy operates, how individuals behave, how collective organizations behave and countries behave. So that scale of transformation, I think we've only started to fully fathom what that involves, the nature and the magnitude of it.
So it's complicated.
That's an excellent summary of this. You know, if you really think about it, what we're trying to do over the next 30 years is transform a system that took 100, 200 years to build, if you think about the time from the Industrial Revolution. So the pace with which we're trying to change is enormously rapid. There's so much inertia in the system, so much that is built into current ways of producing, current patterns of consuming. So that scale of economic transformation that I'm talking about, the pace of economic transformation I'm talking about, it's really unparalleled compared to what we've ever done before. So it is indeed going to be complicated.
Well, thank you again to Dr. Mikkela Krishnan for breaking down this complex but important topic for us. If you are interested in reading her reports on the net zero transition, they are available on her bio page on McKinsey's website. We'll link to it in our episode notes. Be sure to join us again on Monday for our next regular episode. Every weekday, we bring you the day's news in our signature fast, fair, fun 10-minute roundups. So we'll be back on Monday. Until then, have a great weekend.